You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week, we look back at one of the biggest cryptid flaps of the 1960s in the company of Lyle Blackburn. His latest book, The Lake Worth Monster, The True Story of the Greer Island Goatman, reveals a mysterious series of events that culminated in a mass sighting. Along with this, Lyle and I also discuss his latest episode of Monstro Bizarro, which covers a little-known Bigfoot case back from the 1980s. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise store is available through TeePublic. You'll find the link in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Lyle now joins me as we go on the hunt for a pair of elusive cryptids from the past. The long hot summer of 1969 was enough for most residents of Texas to be dealing with, but over in Fort Worth, they had something else to worry about. In July of that year, the area became a hotbed of strange sightings, incidents, and monster hunting, as the hunt became on for the Lake Worth Monster. Joining me to shed some light on one of the best monster flaps of the late 1960s, is the one and only Mr. Lyle Blackburn. Lyle, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. I hope I can shed some light on this dusty old but relevant case.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's always a pleasure to have you back on, my friend. It's always one of those joys in this particular field is you are one of those people that whenever you release either an episode of your wonderful podcast or a new book, I am giddy with excitement like a small child, Lyle.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. And I try to offer quality works and things that people will enjoy.
Yes. I mean, this is one of those because obviously I've heard you speak about this and I know you've touched on it in previous books that you've written in regards to cryptids, Lyle. This is one of those, I think, that as you mentioned on the very first episode of Monstro Bizarro, which covers this particular case, you grew up quite close to this particular area. So is it one of those stories that you've kind of looked back on and thought, I can't believe something like this happened so close to where I was brought up?
Oh, certainly. I mean, unfortunately, it was a bit before my time as far as, you know, being aware of anything like this. But the fact that it happened right in and around where I grew up, you know, I was born in Fort Worth and grew up in this general area. So it was just right there. And all this happened, you know, was in the newspapers. And of course, I would have been all over it at the time. But it's one of those that sort of I wasn't really aware of until later, just because, you know, early on, of course, the only place to find that kind of information is if you read the papers or saw the TV news broadcast. But then beyond that, unless somebody told you about it, you kind of never knew. There was no internet to look it up or to look up old cases. So yeah, that kind of escaped me for a while. But being that I live so close, I think it kind of comes full circle that eventually, you know, if nobody else has picked up the ball, it's like, well, I've got to write the book on this. That it just only seems right.
Yes. Well, I'm going to say if anybody's going to pick up the baton from some of the luminaries that have involved in this case, which we'll touch on when we dive into it properly in a short while, it would be you, Lyle. I would be very disappointed if either you or Ken hadn't touched this case in your writing careers at some point. So I'm glad you've got there, sir.
Right. And it's one of those things that some people have been urging me to write a book on it, but I never felt like I had enough. You know, there wasn't anything sort of any revelations or things that had happened lately. But over time, by, I guess, being recognized for this subject and especially doing lectures at the Lake Worth Library and the Fort Worth Library and area things, people would come up to me and offer insights, and even people who had been there at the time and had witnessed some of this. So over time, I was making firsthand contact with people, and then eventually had access to some archives that had a lot of information and photos that hadn't really been made public. So by virtue of that, and then all of a sudden meeting the son of the original witness, I'm like, okay, now is the time. Now is the time to do it, because I feel like I've got, you know, what the book would deserve.
Mm. I think sometimes this is the problem with some of these historic cases, that depending on when and where they happen, I think that the sort of trail of clues can sometimes dry up very quickly. And I think, as you say there, because your presence has become more widely known in this particular field over the last 10 years, Lyle, I would imagine you have far more presence in the area as being a specialist in these wonderful subjects that you cover than you perhaps did in your younger years. And like you say, when you're doing your lectures and your tours and your talks around the country, not just in Texas, but further afield, the chances are that you will stumble across these people. And with it being a subject so close to your heart, essentially being your nearest cryptid, I would imagine, or serious flap case, it's almost as if it was always going to find you in some way.
Absolutely. And that's kind of how it works a lot of times with this. I mean, I kind of go where things lead me and don't try to force them, because over time, you know, all things will reveal itself if it's the right thing to do. And that's certainly by being recognized in this and being exposed to places where people can come up and talk to me and share stories, then that afforded me something that most people wouldn't have. You know, if you just started from zero and started trying to research this, you know, where do you even start aside from, well, here's some old newspaper articles, here's an old book that has information. But for me, that firsthand contact and just being in the area afforded me, I think, to find things that were relevant to this case that had never been made public, and that really rounded out as the most thorough research that could be done on it.
Mm. As well as when you covered this, because this, the other aspect of this is obviously this was the very first episode of Monstro Bizarro, as I mentioned before, which came out in April 2022, which seems like a million years ago with everything that's happened over the last 3 years long. And so that was very interesting that you mentioned during that particular launch episode that some people had seen you on television who were there in the incidents, and therefore it gave you a bit more. But I suppose does it still surprise you that people will come forward about cases? Because, you know, when we're talking about this one, this is 55 years old. So sometimes people would suspect that, oh, well, you're not really going to have the first-hand witnesses or people who were involved or knew much about it. And yet, time and again, it's all about being in the right place at the right time. And for somebody like yourself, because you've been on television shows and documentaries and you're so immersed in this subject, that kind of gives you a bit more currency in regards to how people trust you, Lyle. And I know you referred to that in the episode of Monstro Bizarro, talking about the Lake Worth Monster, that one of the witnesses who had been involved in some of the incidents had seen you on that. And kind of, do you think it's because he realized that you take him seriously? Because obviously he said, I don't talk about it because everybody used to just laugh at me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, most of the time, if you've seen something weird like this, especially some years ago, if you told friends and family, typically they're just going to laugh. I mean, they're just not going to take you seriously. And, you know, to some people, if they saw something of strange, especially something strange that was, you know, it was covered in the newspapers and everywhere else. I mean, this was actual something, this was an event or events. So I think all of a sudden they see somebody who, oh, well, now this guy seems to take this seriously for whatever reason, for historical purposes or believing that there could be strange creatures out there. They feel compelled to share with you because no one else is really, you know, giving them the time of day about it to think seriously about, well, did you really see something strange out there? And there are strange things in the world. So that brings them forward. And I think they see, I'm just, you know, hey, I'm not judging. I'm just fascinated by the cases. And then they'll share, you know, whatever they have.
I think before I dive into this incredible series of events that happened that summer, primarily, because obviously there's a few things here and there around it. The most recent episode of Monstro Bizarro, which for me is one of the best podcasts in this particular field by a long way, Lyle. I adore the level of care and attention you put into it, the archive interviews that you managed to get hold of, and the way you lay out the timelines, whichever subject you've covered, and you've dived into some brilliant stories over the last couple of years. This most recent episode, I have to say, kind of caught me on the back foot. And I know it was very interesting when you were talking about this, which was obviously the Cowman of Coppolis Beach up in Washington State. Now, I'm not pretending to say I'm very well-versed or the most well-read person in regards to cryptids, but I'd never heard of this story. And I know when you were talking about it on that particular episode, you kind of put forward the idea that a lot of people would see the title and kind of move on and think, well, why am I going to, a cowman, that's a silly story. But once you listen to the experience and this incredible story, you suddenly realize it's a lot stranger than that.
Right. Yeah. It's one that story had limited publicity because at the time it was posted on the internet back in the 90s, you know, there wasn't so much hubbub about Bigfoot and paranormal as there is now. And so it was something that has existed out there. And I had read the story on Bigfoot encounters some years ago. And then what really got my attention is one of my buddies, who's a filmmaker here in Texas, decided to make a movie based on that. And it's a movie called Something in the Woods, and it's a really good Bigfoot film, one of my favorites. And the fact that they based it on that made me look at it again. And then eventually some, you know, I always ask for suggestions and questions on my podcast. And one guy said, hey, I used to live in Coppolis Beach, and you should cover that story. So then I really started looking into it to see. It's a long report and a very well-written story, and you're thinking, okay, is this real or is this fictional? And so that took me down the path to let's just consider this and try to decide whether it's real or not. And obviously something that inspired other people, because, I mean, this guy literally made a movie, and making a movie is a costly venture and takes a lot of time. So yeah, it was fun to explore, and I've got a lot of good feedback from it, because whether people had heard of it before and not thought so much about it, or whether they'd never heard it and now it's a good story, so here it is. It was a fun one to cover.
It's intriguing for me, Lyle, that there are still stories like this that haven't seen a wider audience, really, because you would suspect, as you say, this day and age, you can log on YouTube or numerous podcast applications, and you can find shows that specialize and deal with specific cases, quite historic in certain encounters. And yet this one seems to be one of those that just fell through the cracks. And therefore, it makes you wonder how many more like that are out there that were posted on those sort of early days of the internet and people using geo sites and messaging boards for recording such things, not compared to the websites that we have these days. Do you think the Cowman is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to historic reports like this, that they may still be out there somewhere, we just don't know what sites they've been left on?
Oh, I'm sure there's many of those, because there's a lot of archived things in like the Bigfoot forums chat room. There's you know, Bigfoot Encounters website, which was one started back in the 90s that has just a treasure trove of archival material from newspaper articles to, you know, firsthand accounts and things like that, that, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't get the attention per se is maybe something that happened last week, the latest, you know, fake Bigfoot video or whatever that people will typically bring up. But I'm like, hey, check this stuff out, because I like those older cases, because this was at a time when nobody had Bigfoot on the brain. Nobody, you know, these, if you told these stories, you were, again, liable to be laughed at. And people had to really experience something profound at that time to be wanting to share it, or if it even got shared. So I think those are good cases. And certainly, you know, back in a time when, you know, people were forming these ideas about what Bigfoot was, and this is historical stuff. You know, Bigfoot just didn't happen yesterday. There's all this long history of sightings. So you can go back and pick out some of the most dramatic ones and re-examine those, you know, just like the Lake Worth Monster or the Cowman story, and kind of re-examine those with our thinking now and in a modern lens. And that's what I like to do, because I mean, these are things, again, that had a lot of newspaper coverage. They had news reporters down there. This wasn't just some sighting that was posted in the comments on Facebook. This was something that the whole entire town, for example, or Fort Worth is a huge city, everybody read about the Lake Worth Monster. I mean, this was big news.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I think it's like you say, before we dive into Lake Worth, literally, when you refer to it there, I remember those sort of heady days of the mid-90s, and I used to watch a lot of cable TV shows that had started being shown in the UK from America, sightings and unsolved mysteries primarily, Lyle. And I think people kind of forget, looking back, that, yes, it's only 30 years ago, but between those two shows, I think you can kind of count the amount of Bigfoot stories on two hands. And you think how many episodes they both did. They very rarely touched on it. And there's often this perception that people have always been obsessed with Bigfoot and it's always been there in the media. But I think until sort of the mid-90s onwards, these were more regionally based stories and legends and myths. They didn't get the bigger spread other than the major cases, such as what happened at Patterson-Gimlin, or perhaps Ape Canyon was still quite well known in certain circles. A lot of things like Lake Worth and the Cowman, these are the kind of stories that have always been around, but I think because of when they happened, it's fortunate that Lake Worth especially had a very well-known journalist involved in it. It was widely reported at the time. We've got that newspaper archive. And yet I think people will always think that everybody's always been talking about Bigfoot, because I remember the first time I ever saw Matt Moneymaker was on a very short segment on sightings in sort of about 97. I'd never heard of him prior to that, or the BRFO or any of those organizations at that time. So it shows you that the misconception about Bigfoot always being there and therefore people were always up for hoaxing it simply isn't, their evidence isn't there, because the mass media didn't seem to really care till the late 90s.
Yeah, right. I mean, it was something that was more regionally based. You know, you would hear these stories and sometimes they may make the connection to Bigfoot, sometimes even Yeti. But, you know, these were often just the Falk Monster, Boggy Creek Monster. I would say the majority of the newspaper articles never once mentioned Bigfoot. This was just some monster. So it sort of flew under the radar. Except for those times like that where somebody made a movie or something. But yeah, people, these were few and far between and not widely dispersed as, you know, like they would be now. You know, if you saw anything upright, covered in hair, walking on two legs, it's a Bigfoot, and it doesn't matter where you saw it. It just gets lumped in with Bigfoot, and there's so many people with eyes on that now. But back then, you know, people would say, I saw something that, well, it looked kind of like a gorilla, but not a gorilla, and it stood up like a human. Well, I don't know what it was. And so those weren't as widely publicized. And those are ones that, yeah, I've done this in many cases where I bring all those to light and the relevancy of the history of these strange but true things, you know, and revitalize them in a way like they never, you know, it never got originally beyond the regional newspapers.
Mm. Well, the thing about this particular case, as you've covered in the book, The Lake Worth Monster, when I, because I'm aware of this case, obviously, from hearing your show and reading about it over the years and seeing the alleged photo and reading some of the incidents that occurred during this crazy summer, it's, there's a lot of this that reminds me of the Bishopville Lizard Man, Lyle. I think because we've got lots of similar kind of things going on here. You've got the central case going on. You've got the witnesses. You've got people seeing something that some of them struggled to explain or describe what it was. You've got conflicting reports from witnesses. People, as we'll get into, people describe it looking like one thing. Others say it looks like this. You've also got the fact that it's white, which is a very unusual aspect to it. But also we've got numerous people claiming it's them, and then we start that aspect of it. Well, it can't all you all be it. Some of you are lying, clearly. But when you drill down into it, that's why there's a lot of these parallels you can draw. And I'm sure there's more than just Lake Worth and Bishopville, Lyle. Does it strike you surprising sometimes that when we get these cases, you've got these kind of ingredients that for people like us, as you say, where when you see an upright, hairy creature wandering about, most people will say it's Bigfoot these days. Whereas those two particular cases, you've got, it's like you've got two strands of monster running, but you have to sort of unpick it to realize that perhaps what some people are saying isn't quite right.
Right. There are similarities definitely to the Lizard Man case, where you did have those conflicting descriptions, and that makes it all the more confusing, obviously, is to try to figure out just what the heck it is, if anything.
Yes.
And this one too. But, you know, I kind of chalk that up to, you know, people, you don't have very long to observe these things, and it's not in the best conditions. You know, usually it's at night. It's a scary situation. You know, this isn't a situation where you're going to the zoo during the day and observing an animal that you could give quite a solid description. This happens very fast. It's scary. And so I think that, you know, it's understandable that people got an impression of what they saw in that those moments, as it either ran across the road or it tried to attack them or anything else, that, you know, there's going to be some discrepancy and human error. And, you know, you got to figure these ones that are highly publicized, that it's possible that people saw things that they wanted to believe was the creature, you know, and not that they were purposefully trying to, you know, not a hoax or necessarily, like, it's just people, I saw it. People have reported that out here. It must be it. And here's what I thought, when, you know, perhaps that wasn't even the case. But yeah, that it's just a strange thing. And at the end of the day, you're like, well, people saw something weird. That there's no doubt about it. You know, it's definitely not made up, but it's hard to figure out a solid uniform description, because you're just getting these bits and pieces from various witnesses, you know.
Mm. It's interesting as well that the sort of key incident that kicks it all off to make it cross over, I suppose, into the public domain is this incident with the Wright Guards couple who had gone for a quiet drive somewhere, shall we say, Lyle. But as with some other cases in the past, once this kicks off, all of a sudden the police go, yeah, actually, people have been telling us about this for a few weeks, actually. And this is the same thing here.
Right. It's exactly the same thing. There's always that one seminal incident that, you know, culminates in, you know, the police getting involved in the newspapers. And, you know, that's where we set it off here on July 10th, 1969, in which that the Reichards, John and Linda, were out parking in this area around Lake Worth, which back then it like that area of Lake Worth near this place called Greer Island was a like a lover's lane hangout, you know, where people went to, you know, hang out, even drink beer, but it was also good for fishing. And John Reichard had been in town a little while and heard that there was good fishing at Lake Worth. So he wanted to go out there. He went after work one evening and it was already getting after dark. And he was going to do some night fishing, but his wife really didn't want to get out of the car because she thought it was kind of creepy out there. Even though there was a couple of other cars, some people parked out there, other couples, but still, I mean, this is out in the middle of nowhere. It's a spooky area. So she stayed in the car, but John was down fishing, and he all of a sudden he heard her scream, turned around, and he saw a white something that had gotten onto the hood of the car and then was looking like it was coming around to the passenger side window. So he threw down his fishing rod and ran up there and was shocked because what he saw was what he described as this upright, hair-covered monster. It had white hair, but it looked like it had horns, and he even said it looked like it had scales or something. And he didn't know what it was, but his wife, you know, was obviously threatened by this. So he tussles with this thing a few moments and jumps in the car, and they drive off as this creature scratches at the car. And they drive up to a cafe, which was up on the main road at Jacksboro Highway at the time. And they went in there and had to borrow the phone to call the police. And they were quite, you know, distraught, as you can imagine. And I met this guy named Bill Morris eventually in my talks over there in Fort Worth, and he was actually in the cafe at the time when these people came in, which gave me some better perspective. But he said they were just freaked out, and the police showed up, and you know, they're trying to understand what had happened, and then the other couples that had been down there drove into that parking lot, and they confirmed that something had jumped down on that car and tried to attack that woman. So the police decided, okay, something happened, and we can see a big, long scratch on the car. So they went down there, followed them back down to Greer Island. And of course, you know, by the time they got there, there's no creature to be seen. But that's where it all sort of kicked off, because once that becomes public, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram newspaper, somebody tipped them off with, I don't know who, but you know, by the next day, this is in the newspaper about people seeing a monster at Lake Worth. And then from there, it just snowballed into just a bit of a media circus and a huge monster hunt.
I have to say, I think the headline in the paper has to be one of the best monster-related headlines ever, which is "Fishy Man Goat Terrifies Couples Parked at Lake Worth." But the other one of the great things about this is that obviously the journalist that's writing about this is the legendary Jim Mars. And I'm surprised, Lyle. I know Jim's been passed a few years now. I think it was 2017 he passed away back in his home state of Texas. That a lot of people don't know who Jim Mars is, but he became an international best-selling author in the late 80s, early 90s, focusing on conspiracies and not necessarily what people may perceive the modern interpretation of a conspiracy theory. The book that really broke him internationally was all about JFK. I think it was called Crossfire. And so Oliver Stone based a lot of his JFK film on Jim's book, I believe. There was a lot of sort of cross-pollination of ideas in regards to that. But this was probably one of the stories that gave Jim his thirst for strange things, I think. And for him to be sort of our man on the ground at the time, I don't think we could have asked for anybody better at that particular period, could we?
No, I mean, yeah, it was ironic that Jim Morris was the one that wrote those newspaper articles. And, you know, I think probably he was the guy at the paper that people said, oh, this is a story Jim would like, you know.
Yes.
I'm sure he got past, you know, nobody wants, you know, I'm a serious journalist. I'm not going to write about a fishy man goat. You know, so I'm sure Jim was known as somebody who would, you know, entertain it. He had looked into the story of the Aurora alien crash, which Aurora, Texas is known for, this supposed crash of an alien craft back in the late 1800s, in which they supposedly buried the body of an alien out at this cemetery. And that's also just a stone's throw from Lake Worth. So a lot of weird stuff that went on here. And yeah, you know, I don't know. Jim didn't seem to put a lot of credibility into the Lake Worth monster or some of these others, but he certainly did have an interest, and he certainly did, you know, look into these cases.
I suppose for Jim as well, this is the kind of case that it literally seems to go from 0 to 100 within about a day, Lyle, because as soon as this headline hits, I think it's reported on the radio, and by the late afternoon, you've got a couple of hundred people just hanging around looking for monsters. As we've often seen in some other cases where something kicks off and all of a sudden we sometimes forget that people just start flocking. You know, it happened when the Mothman kicked off. All these people start turning up, driving around with cars full of guns. And the same kind of thing happens here. But what takes this to a different level is obviously within 24 hours, you've got this mass sighting based around the lake, because you've got so many people who were so intrigued that I know people like to say, oh, well, it was probably somebody in a suit just mucking about. But with the greatest respect, even living where I live, I would suspect, Lyle, that this is not the place that you like to run about pretending to be some kind of monster.
Right. I mean, that's just not what most people are going to do with their life, is to dress up in a suit and run around out there and in obviously in a dark, spooky place. And this is Texas. I mean, people carried guns back then. And that was a time period, you know, even when I grew up in the 70s, I mean, my dad drove around drinking a Coors can of beer in the truck, and there was a shotgun in the back window on a rack. I mean, yes. I mean, that's just the way it was. It was just very, I don't know, redneck or some term, but it was just the culture, and it was all about hunting and fishing and all that. So people had guns, and it would not be a time, I mean, even now, but it would just not be a time to dress up in a suit. And you know, back in 1969, your choices of monster suits are very slim. There was not, you can't get an off-the-shelf Bigfoot costume,
yes.
you know, so, or certainly not a white one or something. It you would have to make your own, and to make it convincing just seems hard. And to convince somebody who saw it up close, like John Reichert, you know, I think if you're just wearing a goat skin over your shoulders or something, or had a cheesy mask, I think he would have said some crazy person in a mask. He wouldn't say it was an animal or something, a monster. It just doesn't make sense. And some of the I examine in the book, as you know, about other claims that people had that they were the creature or what have you, but those explanations were either not, it wasn't explaining the whole thing, nor were most of them very convincing as far as the, you know, being an actual creature that, or something people would interpret as a creature. So you always have that in the cases, like, oh, you know, that's just a hoax. It's like people want to act like they know the truth and you don't, or something, and they'll try to explain it away, but that doesn't explain several, you know, months and months or even a few years of weird sightings, much less pictures and other things that had been taken in the Lake Worth monster case.
Well, exactly. And I think this is one of those, again, as you refer to, because of the era and because of the time and how people carried themselves at that particular period, Lyle, a lot of people for recreation and even for employment would be involved in hunting and fishing as a source of income for them. Because once again, this is the kind of situation that we'll often see that people say, well, you know what those kinds of people are like, you know, they're not very intelligent. And I find this infuriating, that people can dismiss such individuals, because they work on the land for their life and their livelihoods, that because they don't have a piece of paper with a college degree written on it, they're clearly not very bright. And it really annoys me, because I think if you're to be a successful hunter, you've got to know about the environment, you've got to know about the fauna, the flora, you've got to know the seasons, migration patterns. These, you can't be a successful hunter if you're an idiot.
Right. I mean, book smarts don't make familiarity with wildlife, and the most credible people are the people who go in the woods and are familiar with hunting and things like that. I mean, I was raised, you know, with my father and my uncle and everybody else in my family hunts, and, you know, no amount of book smarts can make up for just experience in the woods, because, you know, you could hear a scary snort or something in the woods. Well, it's, you know, there's other things. You have to rule out hogs and cougars and all kinds of other things. So I think people who are in those environments are they're at least smart about what's there, and they know the difference in, you know, something that's unusual and unexplainable against, you know, just normal things that are in the woods.
I suppose as well, this mass sighting incident is probably, would you say it's the biggest mass cryptid sighting we're aware of, Lyle? Because I struggle to think of anything similar in regards to the number of bodies that were around at the time when this kicks off that particular evening at the lake. And like we said, even if it is somebody hoaxing it or the excuse that gets put forward, the events of that evening are very hard to believe that even a very strong person could achieve what occurred that evening and also avoid getting shot by a lot of trigger-happy people.
Right, because, you know, the following night on July 11th, after that, the Reichert story had been printed in the newspapers, it immediately went what we would call viral.
Yes.
And by the next evening, there was, you know, 30, 40, 50 people down there in that area where they were parked. And, you know, some of them in a playful manner, we're going to see the monster. And some people serious, we're going to see the monster. And there was even park rangers and police down there. And then, you know, what occurred was this, everyone there, at least 30 plus people, saw an upright figure run up on this ridge and grab a tire with the wheel and allegedly hurl it across, you know, this field over the heads of the stunned onlookers. And of course, at that point, everybody just runs for their lives, because now it's like, okay, there's something weird going on. So in a cryptid case, you very rarely, if any time, have 30 people witness something. And, you know, whether that turns out to be the creature or not, it just puts an emphasis on there was weird stuff going on, and it was witnessed by a lot of people. And yeah, that's just a rarity. And one of the most unique things here is you have a lot of witnesses.
Do you think it's one of those as well, especially with what occurred with this tire, that even if anybody would have perpetuated such an event, the chances of somebody not being hurt here, you couldn't take things into consideration, because obviously we've got the tire being thrown. And I know some people who have claimed to hoax it say, oh, well, we did this and then it bounced off a bit and that's what's made it fly over there. Regardless, you can't guarantee that somebody's not going to get seriously hurt, either in this suit mucking about, Lyle, or one of these people down there looking for the monster. The chances of somebody being hurt, this seems to be one of those where it's pure luck that nobody got seriously hurt by the event.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised that nobody shot somebody down there or, you know, claimed to have shot at the creature, because people were carrying guns. And I have pictures from that very time of some of these guys who were down there touting themselves as monster hunters. And you can see guns in the picture. I mean, one guy with a, looks like it's a 45 strapped to his hip. I mean, this was serious business. And it, to dress up in a suit or to pull anything, especially after it had, you know, been in the papers enough people were down there, you'd have to be totally crazy to go down there, because you could see the guns out there. And of course, there was one alleged story that people had shot at it and it left a trail of blood, but you know, they must have presumably hit the creature itself, because, you know, nobody turned up dead. It wasn't, you know, they didn't accidentally hit a person, but it could have very well happened. And it's amazing that somebody didn't get shot.
I think it's also one of those, even with everybody saying about claiming to have been the person in the suit, like you said, I mean, this is the thing that I think can often get overlooked in this. 1969, you can't just walk into a shop and say, oh, can I have a Bigfoot in a large, please? And even if you wanted to take the time to build a suit, why would you make a white one? Because even after everything, the Patterson-Gimlin footage was out there. I would imagine some people in the area would have seen it on the news at some point, or even in magazines that were released at the time. I think Time did a big feature on it as well back in 67. So that aspect of it, you know, was in the public conscious. But having a white one really just kind of flies against the face of somebody just copying it, because you would think, well, if they're trying to hoax it, surely they'd try and do something like Patty. They wouldn't do something that for the likes of us would be the incorrectly reported Yeti, because a lot of people reported that incorrectly as being white. And then when we look at the original stories from Nepal and Bhutan and northern India, a lot of the descriptions of the Yeti is a sort of grey brown colour. That for me is what takes it away from being a hoax, because it's not like they could have bought a different kind of suit and dyed it or bleached it or wherever. The amount of time to perpetuate something like this and do it well just doesn't seem to make sense. And it almost makes as little sense as somebody claiming what everybody's seeing is a macaque on the run.
Right. The explanations just weren't adding up, you know. And yeah, there was no off-the-shelf white Yeti costume. You know, you could probably buy one of those now, I'm sure, if you Google it, but nothing like that. And certainly, you know, you could probably get a gorilla costume in 1969 that would have been okay, but they're not going to be available in white. So anything like that, that would have had to been made or home crafted. And why would somebody, where are you going to get white? I suppose you could get a fur coat and modify it, but again, it's just going to look pretty hokey and wouldn't fool everyone. You know, it's just not going to work. So those are crazy, you know. And of course, the local authorities or game wardens always say, oh, it's a monkey, or, you know, there's a monkey escaped, or it's a bobcat, which bobcats are not white. Monkeys aren't white, and they're also, both of those are very small. Mm. John Reicher did not fight with a bobcat. He did not fight with a macaque monkey, because the guy would know what a monkey is and a wildcat. So that doesn't explain it. Just does not.
No. But it does make me chuckle, because bobcats are often get put forward for all kinds of things. I think the Beast of Bladenborough, they tried to explain that away as a bobcat and just ignored any other animals that were unfortunately taken afterwards, Lyle. And they always get put forward. And the only thing missing here is a circus train crash, surely.
Right. I'm surprised somebody didn't tell me that, you know, a circus train crashed and that's what it was. But even at that, it's like, what was it? A polar bear? What would be the circus that was white and upright like a Bigfoot? No circus that I know of had one of those.
And to be fair, I don't think a polar bear would be as well behaved, Lyle, if it saw lots of tasty people knocking around, as we're unfortunately aware. Polar bears are not backwards in coming forwards when they're feeling hungry.
That's right. Surely somebody would have been eaten, and that would have, you know, revealed it as a polar bear. But yeah, that if it was the Lake Worth polar bear, it might have been even worse case scenario, because it would have definitely harmed people.
I suppose when you dove into it and look at it, and obviously the events and more people have strange incidents in the following days and weeks. Is it one of those that once you reach this ground zero and go back, was there a history of strange things occurring around the lake? Because obviously it's not a natural lake. It was a man-made one, I think, sort of made in the 1910s to help supply water for the residents, wasn't it?
Right. We don't have any, you know, natural lakes in Texas. So all of them have been, for the most part, have been made by damming up rivers. And so this was a reservoir made by damming up the Trinity River, which is a really significant river here in Texas. And yeah, so it's a place where it was very wild, and that river, the Trinity River, has a long history of weird stuff. And specifically in the Lake Worth area, there had been rumors circulating certainly a few months prior to the Reichards event, where people had even called the police to report seeing something down there that was out of the ordinary. There's no, I couldn't find a real good description on what they reported or whatever, but they had, at least people had been seeing something strange. And then, of course, when you start talking to locals, you know, they'll tell you stories, oh, you know, 30 years ago, this or that. So there was a history of strangeness going on there, specifically in the Lake Worth area, if not just along the Trinity River Basin itself, where you can find other stories that date back some years prior to that, to suggest that, again, this isn't the first time that something's happened. It's just simply the first time that it became known to the public and got in the newspaper. But that's not, you know, where it began. And that kind of supports that, again, the notion that there is something going on here. It wasn't just some wild thing that popped up out of nowhere. There's stuff going on down there.
Mm. I suppose as well, one of the great aspects of this is that, once again, not only have we got Jim Miles reporting it for the newspaper, and I'm quite surprised that when you spoke to Jim later in life, I believe, Lyle, at an event, he was convinced it was pranksters, but there's lots of people that claim to go forward. We also had this local resident called Sally Ann Clark, who seems to be one of those people, and we've got a few of these from certain cases around the US, where a local resident thinks this is really interesting and collects every eyewitness account that they can at the time to create a book. And I'm very envious to hear that you've got several copies, Lyle. And so do you think, once again, this is one of those where we've got a forward-thinking resident who, for our benefit, collated as much as this as possible? Because I would imagine most of the witness accounts that Sally captured at that particular time weren't reported widely in the newspapers either.
No, certainly I give a lot of credit to Sally Ann Clark for being on the scene and having an interest in this to record a lot of these witnesses that would have otherwise been lost, because the newspaper really didn't print a lot of stuff after those first two incidents. The newspaper coverage was sporadic after that. But Sally Ann Clark was down there doing, well, what I would do today is interview people and look into the case. And she wrote that, so she put out that self-published book that amazingly she wrote in just a few months and self-published the thing, which is mind-boggling, because I mean, this was on a typewriter. But that's one reason why the case has had some longevity and people know it outside of the Fort Worth Dallas areas, because that book circulated around and people had it, and guys who were interested in Bigfoot and other things knew about the book, and that helped preserve some of these stories. Otherwise they would have been lost. So of course I'm kind of springboarding on, you know, the newspaper accounts and what Sally had done. And then I'm adding to it what I know of it, and obviously everything that's happened since, including Sally Ann claiming she had later sightings, and this occurred after she wrote the book. So the book, it's one of my prized cryptozoological artifacts, I guess, and I have three copies of it in perfect condition, and that's something that, you know, it becomes a matter of historical record. So fortunately, Sally wrote that book, and I give her a lot of credit for that. Otherwise, I wouldn't have as much to go on here.
It also seems as well that it's one of those that everybody focuses on this initial flap in July and some of the other sort of sporadic events before and after Lyle. But then you look at other events, and clearly there is a history that has continued. Not very common, but it would seem that people have, from the 70s onwards, continued to report peculiar sightings in and around that particular area. I know there's another lake where there's also been some strange incidents. But there's a very interesting story about those chaps who were on the way down there who had read John Green's book. Because I know John Green, I think Apes Among Us, I think it was in the 70s, includes a few pages in regards to the Lake Worth case. And so some people who were Bigfooters at that particular time were really quite interested, because I know Green's book was one of the first ones to kind of take Bigfoot out of the Pacific Northwest and start to look at some of the other cases from around other states, perhaps that Bigfoot wasn't considered to be a resident of, Lyle. And so you've got people from that point on talking about really weird incidents that really frightened them.
Right. You know, you have those continuing events where people are now aware of the history of that area and, you know, have an interest in it and report it in some way, their, you know, what they experience. So that kind of adds to it as to, you know, it's not just something that happened over the course of a few days. It was something that, you know, weirdness went on down there for some time. And even though it's not like, you know, there's sightings every day and in the last few years or anything that would be a continuing situation. But at the time, there was more than just what was in the paper, certainly.
As well, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, one of the iconic things about this particular cryptid is its coloration. And so you would suspect that, well, that would play into the hoax theory, even though we've kind of put that one to bed in regards to this magic white suit that somebody was able to create. But other people saw something white. And if we are to believe that a Bigfoot-type creature, whatever it is, if they're out there, as with any other animal in the natural world, Lyle, the chance of albinism afflicting one or more of them is always there for them, whether it be squirrels or dogs or cats or even normal bears can sometimes have this. We see it in wolves. There is always this chance that there'll be a genetic twist somewhere along the lines. Because I know people have said, well, it can't be Bigfoot because it's white. And I'm thinking, well, why can't it? Because when we look at other reports of Bigfoot and Sasquatch, we've got creatures described as brown, reddy brown, grey, black, some with sort of like a fleckling on them where it's got like multicolours and stuff. So why couldn't we have a white one? That doesn't seem a valid argument. If you're to believe in hominids, then surely you should also believe in genetics causing one or two of them to be a different colour entirely.
Sure. And, you know, that's one thing to examine in the course of this case is like, well, the fact that it's white, does that make it an exception or make it more unlikely, or does it fit with what we might know about Bigfoot creatures? And, you know, most people described the Lake Worth monster as being more like what we would consider a Bigfoot. Now, they weren't using the term Bigfoot in 1969 here in Texas, but they were describing it as in terms of it. It's ape-like, it's upright, it's on two legs, it's hairy, that sort of thing. And so, you know, minus whether it had horns or whatever, it was just pretty much a Bigfoot. So you got to say, well, okay, is this the only case where a Bigfoot might be white? And it's not, certainly, because I there was even reports in this area preceding that where people had reported seeing a white Bigfoot like creature. But, you know, I know a number of witnesses and have recorded, you know, a handful myself over the years of people saying they saw what looked like a Bigfoot that had very light colored hair. And, you know, I include some of those examples in the book to, you know, obviously just say, well, you know, this being the Lake Worth monster being presumably a white-haired Bigfoot does not rule it out as, you know, something that couldn't happen, because there are other examples of these creatures having white hair, and certainly that could be from albinism or whatever age. I mean, you know, humans have all sorts of hair colors, so certainly something like that could, and we see hair color variation in bear. I mean, you know, we got brown and black and cinnamon color and all that. No problem here, I think, if we presume Bigfoot is anything of the sort, that, you know, there could be a variety of hair colors, and that's what is reflected in the reports.
Very true. I mean, I was fortunate enough about 20 years ago, Lyle, to go to Barcelona, and I visited the zoo, and they were famous at that particular time because they had an albino gorilla there called Snowflake.
Right, yeah. Snowflake is a very rare, I think that might be the only example. There's very few examples of gorillas having the albino condition, and I think Snowflake is one of the few examples. So yeah, that's, but there you go. I mean, it's, we know gorillas exist, and there's one with white hair, and you saw it. So yeah, that's a good example. And that, you know, even something like that running through the woods may be even more frightening looking, because it's just so weird. It's like a, you know, like a ghostly kind of Bigfoot. If it's got white hair, that is very strange.
Yes. He was captured in the wild as well. I mean, it's quite a tragic story, because I think the rest of his troop were killed, and he only survived because he was white, and then sold to a primatologist, I think, in the 60s. So he was quite old when he passed away. I think he was nearly 40. But it shows you, I think, once again, it's one of those aspects where, yes, we know where gorillas live and the habitat they have, but the fact that someone stumbled across it makes you think, sadly, have there been other occurrences at that time where they've been killed by poachers or loggers, Lyle, and we've lost other people like we've lost other gorillas like Snowflake, because the people dealing with those just didn't give a damn.
Yeah, it's a shame. I just don't understand that mentality to treat our fellow earth dwellers in such disregard, killing these animals for, I don't understand it whatsoever. And I think that, you know, a lot of people say they hope that Bigfoot is never discovered, because we've seen what we do with other rare animals, and certainly we wouldn't want this to happen if we discovered Bigfoot. So, you know, I think if I had an opportunity to escort one into society, I probably wouldn't, because I wouldn't want them to have the same kind of thoughtless treatment. So yeah, it's mind-boggling about that. But yeah, certainly there could have been other albino gorillas that weren't as fortunate as Snowflake, if you call he or her fortunate.
Absolutely. And and the other aspect of this is, but as we know, the majority of Bigfoot and hominid reports from the southern states tend to be the traditional colorization, Lyle. One would suspect if you're going to be slightly lighter or have a lighter coloring, you would usually be in a very sunny state such as Texas or California or New Mexico. And yet we know that majority of people who see things of that ilk in these particular areas do report the normal ones. That also lends a bit of credence in the fact that usually, as we've discussed in some of the Lake Worth's other relatives in neighboring states, they seem to be a bit skinnier, a bit smaller, and therefore you would suspect, well, maybe it was just, like you say, it could have been very old, it could have been just normal colorization because of its environment. Who knows?
Right. Yeah, I mean, these things can fit well with what we know of the natural world, even the fact that something in the south may be smaller than its brethren in the north. Bergman's law is kind of applies to bears. You know, if you see a bear in the Texas woods, it's going to be a lot smaller than a bear you might find in the Pacific Northwest. That is a fact. So, you know, creatures down here, if they're reported as being 5, 6, 7 feet tall, as opposed to what, you know, some towering 8-foot Bigfoot, that, you know, maybe a classic from the Pacific Northwest doesn't raise any, you know, doesn't raise the alarms, because that would fit.
Is Fort Worth proud, happy, surprised that this creature is still so highly thought of as a strange cryptid case, Lyle? I mean, sometimes you see places and they don't hold on to their monsters and their flaps. Others embrace it, and some would say it saves the town at where it happens on occasions. As I'm sure I've said before, Point Pleasant and Van Meter are two prime examples of small towns who, with the greatest of respect, probably wouldn't have a lot to attract people if it wasn't for their cryptid histories. Fort Worth seems to have treated this with quite a bit of love, and still does to this present day, does it not?
Yeah, in a way, they have preserved this. I mean, Fort Worth, the city as a whole, doesn't really need the Lake Worth Monster, because, you know, we have the stockyards and the historical cowboy attractions, Billy Bob's, which is a famous music venue. But, you know, the Lake Worth area, which is a smaller community north of Fort Worth, has, you know, preserved this history. And now the area where Greer Island and all this took place is part of the what's called the Fort Worth Nature Center. And that's a wildlife preserve, a nature preserve out there in the area. And they certainly do really, really appreciate the Lake Worth Monster history, because it keeps some interest. And they do what's called the Lake Worth Monster Bash. They only do it every 5 years out at the Fort Worth Nature Center, this being one of the years when they're going to do it. They, you know, whether they believe the creature's real or not, they know it's something of interest, and they will do this. And if you go to the Nature Center, there's an interpretive building where they have, you know, displays of various nature from around this area. And there is small things there that represent the Lake Worth Monster. So they certainly appreciate it and embrace it, as far as, hey, this is part of our history, it's fun stuff, and you know, why not? So I appreciate that, and that they've been very helpful in my research and gathering materials for the book. And you can see I have nearly 40 some odd photos in there, and a lot of those came from their archives that they've collected over the years. So thankfully, you know, that's something else that I can offer in preserving the history of this. And certainly the Lake Worth Library, they've had me out there to speak on this subject. And, you know, it'll draw 100 people that want to come out there and listen and learn. And yeah, so there's still an interest in this, even though it's, you know, a blip on the history map of Fort Worth, with so much history here in terms of the Old West and the cattle industry and all that. But yeah, it really amazes me that people, you know, take an interest in this, and I'm happy to share it. And one reason I wrote the book, I'm like, hey, you know, this is something. There's an event that literally the city of Fort Worth endorses and promotes. I'm thinking, well, you know, hey, there should be a book for those that want to know the full history. Here it is.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the great aspects of this particular book, is the treasure trove of pictures. I mean, there's the one, is it Bobby Brooks, who drew a full-size image of something that he saw? And there's a photo of him standing there, I think, with Sally Ann Clark and one of the local police officers. And you just think, with the greatest respect, other than people visiting Fort Worth, Lyle, how many people have seen that picture outside of your book?
Right, not many. It's huge. It's like an 8 foot tall illustration that's framed. And yeah, that's a nice artifact. And that the last I had seen of it, it was over at Sally Ann Clark's home, and in the possession of her family. But Bobby Brooks has become a friend of mine, and he's the guy that drew the artwork on the cover of her book, and he drew that huge drawing that was photographed a lot over the years. There's a photograph of John Green the famous Bigfoot author researcher in front of that thing. So that's something that, you know, when I got my photograph in front of it, I'm like, ah, man, this is like a piece of crisp cryptid history and, you know, things that can be preserved. I don't know where that is exactly now, but I'd certainly like to have it in my collection if it ever comes up, you know.
Well, stranger things have happened. I was watching Antiques Roadshow, a program over here, Lyle, the other week, and three ladies turned up with this very strange necklace, and it turned out that their great aunt was one of Aleister Crowley's disciples in the Golden Dawn, and they'd had this necklace for 70 years and they didn't know where it was, and it had all these sort of occult symbols on it, and they just basically had it in a drawer for ages, and they thought it was something, they thought it was Italian, and then when they dug into it on the show, they were saying, oh yeah, this is the necklaces that members of the Golden Dawn wore. So it just shows you that you never know when something weird and spooky will be found and preserved for us to discover 50, 60 years later. Because that was just jaw-dropping, because I don't think they knew anything about it until they said the word Aleister Crowley, and you could see their jaws drop.
They're like, oh no, what do we have?
Cursed necklace.
Right, yeah, that's amazing. And it's just thankfully those ladies had the wherewithal to have it looked at, because otherwise, yeah, it's just sitting in a drawer somewhere and no one knows where it is or that it even still exists.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, I know you refer, there's a couple of pictures that have been sort of redone under direction of the families and the witnesses. But we know that there's probably lost things out there for numerous cases. This is a great example, but we've still, because of the diligent research and the love that certain local officials and institutions had for the case, that I doubt many other cases such as this. I know when, you know, once again, going back to Bishopville, you've certainly got a small sort of collection of items there, including some of those crazy T-shirts that people were selling at the time, Lyle. And yet this one, we're very fortunate, it would seem, that we have such artifacts available to us that perhaps certain other places, other cases, they'd have just been thrown in the bin or locked away somewhere.
No, certainly. You know, I mean, if it's not appreciated and people don't realize what it is, this stuff can disappear. So, you know, I try to, if I become aware of any of that sort of stuff, I try to make sure that I can, if I can acquire it or I can get it in one of the cryptid museums or whatever else, that's the place where people can appreciate it.
Mm. I think the last aspect I want to touch on, do you think it gets sort of mislabeled in regards to this? Because obviously, as we say, some of the original witnesses made it out as though they saw a goat man. So this sometimes, the Lake Worth monster often gets, especially with that photo as well, or whatever that is, it sometimes gets roped in with things like the Pope Lick monster and the goat men in obviously you've got a goat man in Texas, you've got a goat man in Maryland, Lyle. Do you think, as we were saying about the cow man, is it one of those that because it gets mislabeled in certain areas that perhaps some people miss this case because they think, oh, it's a goat man, well, they can't exist, and therefore they don't dive deeper into it?
Yeah, I think so. And it can add a silly aspect about it, you know, the idea of a goat man or just seem more not as credible than maybe we think of something like Bigfoot. But it also gives it the unique thing. And that's one thing. And even the title of my book, it says, you know, Greer Island Goatman, because that's kind of how it's known. But, you know, it makes it stand out a little bit because, I mean, there's, you know, the Goatman cases are a little bit more few and far between, and we do have a witness here who said it had horns, so
yeah,
just going by that. But it and Greer Island Goatman just sounded good, so so I, you know, I like the alliteration with the G's, but yeah, it gives it a bit of a standout in personality, and I think that makes a little bit more fun with the case. And of course, once you delve into any of these cases, whether it be the Falk monster or the Lizard Man or whatever that have a regional name, you always see that there's no really one set thing. You know, nobody didn't walk into town in the middle of the day where everybody could examine it detail by detail. I mean, this is, again, a shadowy creature that people get glimpses of and often in stressful situations. So no matter what we call them, or a cowman or whatever, that gives it a little personality. But at the end of the day, it's still a plausible and spooky case where people saw what we essentially lump into the major category of monsters.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating case. And once again, another wonderful addition to your bibliography that is building year on year, Lyle. And like I say, I always love it when I get a little notification from Amazon, especially when I'm not expecting it. A bit like yourself and David Weatherly, it's a real bonus when I get a notice saying, you may be interested in their new book. And I'm like, brilliant, I am. So for you, is this the time of year that you've basically got to try and survive the rest of October as much as you can, Lyle, either through appearances, speaking events, performing with your band, and then as well probably doing some research and investigation and kind of easing into the end of the year? Or have you already got your next project lined up and you're about to enable us all to rediscover another lost story?
Well, my mind works that way, where I just finish one thing and I'm already spinning around in my mind trying to decide which one to pursue next, because I like to create these things and delve into these cases. But yeah, it did definitely at this time of year, I've got a lot more appearances that go through Thanksgiving to get out there and obviously share information and promote the book and things you need to do to make the efforts worthwhile. And so, yeah, I think I've done more events this year than I've ever done. And there're just so many of them. So I've got to try to not commit to so much stuff, because, you know, at the same time, I got to do research and, you know, hope to do some podcast episodes, which sort of is just all random. So I don't ever really announce schedules or dates like that I'm going to release products. I just work on them. And whenever I'm done, hey, everybody, here's something. That way I don't commit to more than I can do. And, you know, I just do the things that interest me ultimately. And hopefully everybody else has an interest as well. That way I just go where the inspiration and things lead, which I think leads to the best result. And that includes the podcast. You know, I can't promise a schedule, but I can promise some interesting stuff. So that's kind of the way I roll. And the rest of the year, I'll get through these events and all the travel. And then I've got some stuff lined up to get back out in the field and just enjoy some time in the field while there's some good weather here and it's not too hot and it's not yet too cold.
Yeah. Perfect research weather, Lyle, it would suggest. And I suppose that's the great thing about your body of work, is that you're not tied to a schedule. So it gives you a bit more flexibility, which I think, because of the way you work, it probably fits a lot better for you. And therefore, you're not constrained by regularity, as it were, Lyle.
True. That's why I don't have a quote unquote real job, because I don't want something like that. And people, man, you should have a TV show and stuff. And I was like, yeah, but that's kind of like having a boss and kind of like working a job. So I prefer to remain a free agent and do what I want when I want. And that's fits better with my lifestyle.
Well, it's a wonderful book. As I say, you've got a brilliant foreword by Craig Woolheater, good friend of yours, and obviously a well-known Texas Bigfooter and experiencer himself, and a wonderful cover by Jonathan Dodd. And so, Lyle, where can everybody get hold of a copy of this book, your previous work, and also catch up with the missed episodes of Monstro Bizarro, which, why anybody in this field isn't listening to that particular show, I don't know.
Right. I still have people come up to my events and buy books and stuff that are the fans, and somehow they're not aware of the podcast, but I guess I do a lot of stuff, so I get it. So, yeah, Monstro Bizarro, my podcast, can be found on all major podcast platforms. So, you know, that should be easy to find. And my books are available on Amazon, of course, in paperback and ebook formats. And if you want to get an autographed copy, that would be the best choice. And those are available from my website at lyleblackburn.com. I've got an online store there where you can purchase books and other things. So if you want to find out more information about me, lyleblackburn.com would definitely be the place to start.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links, as always, into the show notes so people can track down everything that we've just mentioned. And as always, I want to wish you the very best. Thank you, as always. I look forward to our next conversation with your next surprise release, no doubt, Lyle. And I want to wish you and your family the very best for the rest of this year. Thank you, as always, my friend.
Thank you a lot. Appreciate it.